Well, good evening. I'm pleased that Jinanda and Ratna Prabha have given sort of a bit of introduction both to the Sutra and to the Mahayana, because that helps me quite a bit. I'm going to do a little bit more of an introduction to the Sutra and to the background to it. And I'm going to keep flipping between glasses, because I can read with my glasses on but not see you, but then I can't read with them up like that, but I can see you. So it's going to be a question of doing this quite a lot.
Got a cigar to go with it.
I was thinking of doing a bit of performance sort of during the... But let's see if I've got the courage. A cigar, I don't think a cigar will be necessary. So this is... I'm going to tell you a story from the White Lotus Sutra, which is included in this volume of sutras. And a fine book. And Sangharakshita has written a commentary on it, which you could read as well. It's worth reading the White Lotus Sutra. As Ratna Prabha says, it's full of stories, fascinating stories, very enjoyable stories. But Sangharakshita's introduction kind of helps you to get a grip on what's actually going on. So tonight I'm going to tell the story of the rich man's son from the White Lotus Sutra. And as I said, a bit of background before that. So we've been telling stories on Tuesday nights for some weeks now, and we began with ones from the Buddha's life and teachings, and from the Pali Canon, from the Pali Canon, the Buddha's life and teachings, and from Jataka tales. And then last week we heard something not from the Pali Canon, but from a later tradition of Buddhism, which was established in Tibet. And that was the life of Milarepa, the Tibetan yogi and poet. So tonight, we're going to sort of go back again a bit, not as far back as the Pali Canon, but to the sutra that was a sutra that was written down in India about 600 years after the Buddha's death. So in about the first century CE, the White Lotus Sutra, as Ratna Prabha says, in Sanskrit it's the Sadharma Pundarika Sutra. And that sutra was later translated and spread throughout the Buddhist world and became very well known in the Far East, and its stories are very much loved and often told in the Far East. And in this sutra we find a different atmosphere from that which we find in the Pali Canon, really. The Pali Canon seems to largely represent goings on in a historical time, in a world we substantially recognise as our own. There are miraculous events and plenty of poetic and mythic material too, but on the whole we're following events and teachings we can relate to as happening in a world we know. That's in the Pali Canon. But not so much in the White Lotus Sutra. Here we're almost entirely in a poetic, visionary world. The sutra begins, as many Pali Canon texts do, for example, with the Buddha seated among his followers in the open air, and he addresses them. But here a ray of light suddenly emanates from between the Buddha's eyes, revealing to his audience the whole universe, including all the heavens and hells, with all the Buddhas in all those worlds preaching the Dharma. Also, the audience itself is quite special. It includes not just the Buddha's monks or bhikshus, but bodhisattvas, with names like the Bodhisattva Regarder of the Cries of the World, the Bodhisattva Precious Moon, the Bodhisattva Never Stopping, as well as all the gods of all the levels of heaven. So we're in that sort of world. It's no less real than the more historical world of the Pali Canon, but far wilder, more colourful, far stranger, and far beyond what our rational minds would normally expect to encounter. And the reason why there is this difference between the sutra, the White Lotus Sutra and the Pali Canon Sutras, is that between the Buddha's death and the first century CE, a new movement rose up in Buddhism in India. And this was called, or called itself, the Mahayana, or Great Way, or Great Vehicle. And Mahayanists felt that the original ideas of Buddhism, the initial energy and spiritual depth and breadth of the Sangha, and the teachings of the Buddha's time and the first centuries after had been lost sight of. They felt the goal had narrowed from the Buddha's own great example of compassion for all to being a goal for liberation for oneself. They felt as time went on, the Dharma hadn't been heard any longer for what it really was, and people making less of it than it really was, and were too concerned with themselves and with rules. They weren't hearing the Dharma as the liberating, mind-expanding, unshackling thing it really was. The Mahayanists also felt that whereas the Buddha himself had communicated the Dharma by any means he could, as best suited his hearers, so discourse or stories, poetry, or even just holding up a flower on one occasion, the Buddhists of their day had become too heady and intellectual. They were obsessed with the rational, with pinning down ideas. This is how the Mahayanists felt, anyway. Whereas, after all, the Buddha was pointing to a reality that went beyond ideas. And so the Mahayanists called this kind of run-down, more individualistic, more intellectual sort of Buddhism, as they felt it had become, they called this the Hinayana, the narrow or lesser way. But there wasn't a schism. It's not that Mahayanists and so-called Hinayanists fell out. They continued to live together in the same monasteries and universities and followed the same monastic codes. So it wasn't a question of a split. The Mahayanists had a point to make, but they wanted to renew the Sangha, not split it. So they made their points simply by teaching and sharing their inspiration from different sorts of sutras. And so these different sorts of sutras, they wouldn't have called them new, but they kind of started to appear around this time. They sort of began to be found, as it were, and were taken to be utterances of the Buddha or the enlightened mind. And as I say, they were written down. Maybe their oral tradition was longer, but they were written down, started to be written down in the first century CE. And as I say, they were different in atmosphere from the Pali Canon, quite different. And in them, the Buddha preaches essentially the Mahayana. He preaches the Mahayanist renewed insight that the pursuit of enlightenment for oneself was the pursuit of something impossible, was a contradiction in terms. The Mahayanists saw that a true urge to enlightenment could only be an urge, an aspiration for the enlightenment of all beings. The true aspirant identified not just with himself, but with all life, and recognized the will to, the need for, even the birthright of enlightenment in all life. He couldn't aspire to the enlightenment of just a little bit of it, his own ego. So they taught a higher ideal, the goal of the Bodhisattva. Enlightenment, not just for himself or herself, but for all beings. Enlightenment for the sake of all beings. And this, they said, was the Buddha's true enlightenment, the great enlightenment, not just a narrow wish to escape one's own suffering. So many of these sutras presented such teachings, and not just in analytical philosophical terms, but in stories, vivid images, and highly coloured poetry, the non-rational, and using all these means to appeal to the whole person, not just the intellect, and using the variety of means which they felt the Buddha had originally used. So the White Lotus Sutra is one of those kinds of sutras. It's been called a cosmic drama. It's a poem with many voices. The Buddha speaks, other characters speak to him or to each other about his teachings, and meanwhile a huge sort of vista opens up far beyond the historical world into the visionary world. And the sutra addresses, among other things, a difficult problem. And here we start coming to the story eventually, but the problem was, how were the Mahayanists going to persuade those they regarded as Hinayanists, the narrow-wayists, that they, despite all their learning and their strict adherence to the Vinaya, the code of conduct, their asceticism, their skillful and deep meditation, all their practices built up and honed over many years, even decades, how are they going to persuade them that they hadn't quite got it? They weren't there yet. There was something missing from their spiritual outlook. Though many of them probably thought they were there, that they were fully enlightened, and there was no more to do, in fact, that wasn't the case, according to the Mahayana. They had a bit of a way to go. They weren't really yet enlightened in the way that the Buddha was enlightened, though they may have achieved some sort of personal release. Though this would be quite a delicate thing to put across and could cause a bit of distress. And this issue comes up in a dramatized way or a mythic way in the White Lotus Sutra. So the Buddha is preaching to his assembled followers, and they're all listening attentively, ready to listen. Some of them have been practicing for 20, 30, 40 years. They're called Maha this, Maha that, out of respect. They may be preceptors, teachers in their own right, very much respected in the Sangha, even famous in their own way. And they get ready to hear the teachings they've heard so often before, as the Buddha has always preached them, almost simply to be confirmed in their spiritual lives, to be reaffirmed, almost just for the pleasure of recollection. They want to hear the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, the 12 Links, the so many hundred rules of the Vinaya, that enlightenment is the extinction of suffering. And then the Buddha suddenly says, okay, but that's not really it. All this I've taught you over the years, and you follow so diligently, well, that's not it, actually. That's not the end of it, anyway. You see, I just teach the Dharma any way I can. I teach it in a way that people can understand, can hear, that's suitable for them. Then when I've got them to a certain point, well, then they're ready to hear the real Dharma. This is how Buddhas throughout time have taught the Dharma, the Buddha says. And now I'm going to reveal to you the final teachings, the real teachings, the way to real enlightenment, to great enlightenment, not the lesser vision, which I'm afraid you've been following all these years. So, after that there's silence, while the Buddha waits to see the reaction, and 5,000 bhikkhus walk straight out. So they're shaking their heads, they're flinging their robes about, they're disgusted, they're kicking the dust off their feet. I've been practicing this stuff for 30 years, I'm enlightened, how can there be any more to it? What have I got to learn? No, the Buddha's gone mad, who does he think he is? He's lost it, I've had enough, I'm off, I don't need this. So this is even before they've heard what the Buddha's new revelation is, before they've heard the Mahayana. And for others, it's not so much pride, it's despair, it's exhaustion. I've been practicing for 40 years. It hasn't been easy, you know. What does the Buddha think I've been doing all this time? Playing tiddlywinks? Isn't it good enough? Well, there's more to do. If there's more to do even now, I might as well give up. I can't carry on. I'm an old man. I've had enough. I'll go and see if my wife will take me back. But some do stay. They're bewildered and confused. But even so, their faith in the Buddha is such that they stay. And if anything, it's themselves that they question. Well, if there's even more to be done than what I've done already, I don't know if I'm up to it. Am I good enough to hear these higher teachings? I guess not. If I had been, the Buddha would have taught me them before. He said himself he teaches according to what people are capable of hearing. Obviously, I'm not capable of hearing the truth. Still, I'll hang around, I'll see what he has to say. And the Buddha says, ah, good, okay. You're the ones who can hear my true teachings. You're the bodhisattvas. You didn't jump up and go off in a huff, just thinking of yourselves and standing on your pride. You stayed. You're the ones. So this teaching is for you. And after you've heard my true teachings, you will gain the great enlightenment, perfect enlightenment, the Mahabodhi. I assure you absolutely that you will attain this enlightenment. So this is a great weight seems to fall off the bhikshus who've stayed behind. And their overwhelming experience is one of gratitude. So now they realise that far from having lost anything or wasted their time or being misled, they've only gained. They've been shown that whatever elevated world they thought they lived in, it was only a small world. only concerned with themselves. Now they've been told that they can soon enter a far greater world, a more all-encompassing world, that the path they've been following, wherever they thought it led, has been towards this, really. Mm. All the time this was their birthright, their true goal, did they but know it. This more far-reaching, more all-encompassing, great enlightenment, identifying with all life, with the whole universe. So to them, they've got more than they thought they deserved. They've received something totally beyond their expectations, unlooked for. Their teacher was always going to give them this. It was always there for the taking. They simply never knew it, never knew enough to ask, and yet it will be given to them. And in their joy, they tell the Buddha a story to show him how they feel. And this is a story I'm going to tell. Now anyway, so that was background. Everything I've told you, just put that aside for the time being. Because the story they tell is ostensibly to show how the Buddha's hearers felt at the Buddha's revelation of their destiny. But being a good story and being a Mahayana story, it's about much more than that. So just listen to the story and let it kind of work and let it wash over you, and then afterwards we'll see what it means to us and what meanings we can draw from it. So this is what the Buddha's followers tell him out of gratitude. This is the story. It's like this, they say. Once there was a youth who was very immature and ignorant, and he ran away from his father. He went off as far as he could to faraway countries. And he's away for years, 10, 20, 30 years. But all that happens to him is he becomes needier and needier the older he grows. He hires himself out as a labourer. So any boss will have him. When he can't find work, he begs. Sometimes he's reduced to begging for clothes and food. And sometimes he gets something, sometimes nothing at all. His father at first searches everywhere, but can't find the son. And after much wandering, the father settles in a certain city. And he becomes rich over the years. He's a merchant, and his kind of business, his enterprises are very successful. And soon he's got a business empire that stretches over many countries with all the usual trappings. Elephants, cattle, slaves, servants, gold, gems, and a house that's like a palace. And in the palace, he has what's more or less a throne covered in lion skins. It's quite nice. I quite fancy one myself, actually. But when he feels like sitting outside, he can have the throne sort of carted out and a canopy stretched over his head, and he can sit in the sun, draped with flowers. But he's never forgotten his son. He doesn't speak about it, but he thinks about his lost son all the time. And he thinks to himself, I've got all this wealth, but no one to pass it on to. I'm getting old. If only I had my son to hand my fortune over to, then I'd be happy. And meanwhile, an amazing coincidence occurs. The son ends up in the very city where his father has settled. He's kind of zigzagged and wandered all over the country, or various countries, for many years, until he ends up in the very city where his father now lives, unbeknown to either of them. But by this time, the son is in a really terrible state. He's at the lowest ebb you could possibly imagine. He's starving, gaunt, he's covered in scabs. His clothes are hanging off of him, such as they are. So he wanders around the city just as he wanders everywhere. And at last, he's kind of drawn, strangely and irresistibly, to the magnificent sight of an extremely rich man in his finest clothes, sitting on this lion throne outside his house, having his money counted by his servants. So the son watches. He thinks, well, would you look at that? There's a rich so-and-so, if you like, some sort of magnate. Could be the king around here, I suppose. Rich as Croesus. All right for son, isn't it? What am I doing here? What am I thinking? There's no way I'm going to get any work out of a man like that. I'd better get myself off to some dump of a town where it's more likely someone will hire me, the likes of me. Yep, better scoot. Sorry, I'm overdoing this a little bit, but better scoot. Then there's no telling what these people will do, rich people. You can't trust them. Any chance he gets, he'll oppress me. It'll probably take me to forced labour. Right, I better hop it. So the son runs off. However, though the son couldn't recognise his own father, the father has recognised his son, even through the grime and tattered clothes and even at a distance. And the father's overjoyed. What an amazing thing to happen, he thinks, that the son I thought I'd lost should just turn up like that of his own accord. So he says to his servants, right, quick, I'm sure that's my son, go and get him, don't let him get away. So the servants run after the son and get hold of him, but the son's terrified and screams, what have I done? I haven't done anything, I've done nothing to you, what do you want, what's going on? So he struggles, but the servants, obeying their master's instructions, drag him towards the rich man's house. The son thinks, even though he's committed no crime, he thinks he's being arrested and that he'll be imprisoned and probably executed. So now, absolutely terrified, he faints and collapses between the two men who are dragging him along. Now, the father's been watching from a distance and he sees all this going on, so he sends another servant over to the first two. He says, look, tell him to stop. It's all right, I don't need this man after all. There's been a mistake. Don't use force on him. Sprinkle water on his face to bring him round, then don't speak to him any further. However, the father knows full well this is his son. But he's realised that because of the low state his son has sunk to, his own wealth, the father's wealth and lordly appearance has caused distress to his son, and he's afraid of him. And even if he told him he was his father, the son wouldn't believe it. He wouldn't trust him. But he says nothing about this to the servants. He tells him to say to the son, it's okay, we set you free, just go wherever you want. And at this the son's delighted. Ha! I'm free, you don't catch me, you don't get old Sharky. Greased lightly I am, I'm off. And he goes off immediately to the worst and most run-down hamlet he can find to beg for food and clothes. But the rich man has a cunning plan. Secretly, he sends some men after his son, men of doleful and undignified appearance, it says in the sutra, grimy, badly dressed, and one with a scar. And on the rich man's orders, they say to the son, we know where there's work. You can get double wages. It's clearly a heap of dirt. You'll be working with us. It says dirt in the sutra. I think that's a euphemism. Now, this is the sort of work and the sort of people that the son can understand, so he goes with them. He's paid in advance, and then with the other two men of unprepossessing appearance, he starts shoveling away the dirt. The father watches all this from the window, day after day. He's filled with wonder and compassion. The son remains thin and filthy, and if anything, he gets more filthy from the dirt and the muck he's shoveling. And he doesn't look very happy. So the father swaps his own rich clothes for some tattered old ones, smears himself with dirt, picks up a shovel, and walks out with a suitably stern, sort of foreman-like expression. And he barks at the other labourers, come on, get on with it, no slacking. And he comes up by his son, and he says to his son, well, you seem to be doing pretty well. You're not lazy like the others. I haven't seen you getting up to their tricks. I hope you'll stay around. Tell you what, I'll increase your wages. We could use a worker like you around here. And another day he compliments him again, and this time offers him a better class of food than he's used to, from the palace's kitchens. Just come and get it whenever you want it, he says. Another day he gives the son his own assistant, some old clapped out servant he can boss around himself. Another day he pats him on the shoulder and says, you're doing very well. I really appreciate what you're doing here, clearing this muck. I've never seen a muck clearer quite like you. Come and get whatever you want from the house, whenever you want. And don't think of me as just your boss. Think of me as a father. Finally, he says, Sharky, is that what you call yourself? You can't go on calling yourself that. And he gives him a new name and says again, you're like my own son. So the son's very happy about all this, but he still thinks of himself as a humble hireling and nothing else. So he carries on shoveling dirt for 20 years. After that period, he's just about started to feel comfortable enough and confident enough in the old man's presence to go in and out of the palace at leisure. The father employs him more on house affairs and in some aspects of his business. And he becomes the father's right-hand man, his sort of steward. But he still lives in the hovel in the yard where he's always lived all this time. Now the old man becomes ill. He knows he hasn't got long to live. And if he's going to pass on his wealth, he'd better do it soon. But the good thing is he knows that his son has really come on. He's come on a long way. He's a bit more refined, a bit more comfortable around all the fabulous wealth. He's a bit less awkward in the rarefied atmosphere of the palace. So the old man now reveals to him the full extent of his wealth and takes him into his confidence about his business affairs. I want you to make yourself familiar with all my accounts, all my contracts, all my income and outgoings, he says, so that you can help me run the business. So the son sets to work learning everything he needs to learn, and after a while the father checks out what he's learnt, asks his opinion on things, and then says, right, good, you know everything I know, and we're in agreement on what needs to be done. We're of the same mind, so now you can run the business. And the son does this successfully, but even so he lives in the same hut in the grounds. He comes to the palace, works there, but returns every night to his hovel. He sees that as his place in life. However, the father sees that the son nevertheless really has come on. His tastes have changed, his outlook has broadened, so he knows that now is the time. He brings together all his relatives, servants, employees, and his whole retinue, and seats the son in front of them. He says, ladies and gentlemen, this is my son. I've treated him like a son and asked him to see me as a father. But in fact, he really is my son and I really am his father. And he tells them the story of how 50 years ago now, the son left home to go wandering and what happened to him and how they've now gradually become reunited. And now everything I own is his, says the father. He knows everything there is to know about my business and all its income and outgoings. He's free to use my wealth as he will. Ladies and gentlemen, my son. And at this, of course, the poor son is overcome with joy. The news is still a total surprise to him, and all he can do is marvel that such luck has come his way, that all this wealth that he never strove for has just landed in his lap. And that's the story. So as I say, this is the Buddha's followers. They tell him that story to express how they feel about their luck in hearing him expound the Mahayana for the first time. You've told us how to be faultless in practicing the Hinayana, how to escape suffering, but not until now have you told us that we too can become Buddhas, and that all who practice the way can become Buddhas. Up to now we've been pleased with mere trifles. That's what the Buddha's disciples tell him. But I think we can see in the story a lot of other resonances and meanings. To me it seems a story of a great psychological and spiritual resonance, and with many different meanings, many facets, but we can just touch on a few of them perhaps. So first of all, the son in the story has to be led gently to the truth by stages. Humankind cannot bear very much reality, as T.S. Eliot says in the Four Quartets. So even if the truth is glorious and liberating, we can't always bear it at once. We have to be led to it by stages. We're so fond of our present views, including our present self-view. We're comfortable with it. We know how to operate with it. We can always fall back on it. Sometimes if someone tries to tell us the truth, when it contradicts what we already know or goes beyond it, we get angry. Defensive. So how many times have we found out truths or been told truths, perhaps about ourselves, that could be liberating because they are truth, yet we close our minds to them as soon as we can. We try to run away. I know this has happened to me. A few years ago my father died, and for a while the experience gave me a different perspective, a more realistic perspective on life. A broader perspective. I seemed to know what was essential and what was trivial. in the face of the fact of death. But I know that I've buried that truth again now. It's something I seem to just know as part of my body, in a way. Now I might know intellectually, but I've lost that kind of that knowing, that certainty, and that perspective I had. So it was like a patch of light opened up in the fog of my views, but it's closed again. So you run away and from the truth, and maybe a gentler and perhaps surer way is to be led to the truth sometimes by stages, and to be eased out of our limiting views by lesser truths. But in general, the story I've told is obviously making a point about the effect, the whole effect of self-views on our lives. The point about the son, of course, is he doesn't just end up in objectively poor and degraded conditions. He can't see that he deserves anything else. His self-view just won't rise above the poverty that he already knows. I think we can probably see how self-view has affected us through our lives. Some people just do have very low self-esteem for whatever reason. And whatever their objective chances in life have been, that view really holds them up. They're not able to see or take advantage of all the chances they're given. Maybe somehow they don't feel worthy of anything better than they have. And they wouldn't feel comfortable somehow in taking an opportunity to move ahead in life. And of course this isn't really about money or career or whatever. It's about our general attitude to life. Expansive. So our attitude to life, is it expansive, creative, going out to people, or on the other hand narrow, self-protective, over-careful? And poor self-view really is tragic, because it leads us to miss so much in life. Our sense of limitation makes us hold back from doing so many things we could do in life, prevents us from enjoying even the things we do, for fear of doing them badly. And yet I'm talking from experience. In a way, such a view leads us to cower away from life, not take part in the sort of big out there. It can make us unable to accept love because we don't feel worthy of it, or unable to give love because we can't believe anyone would want our love. As Ezra Pound writes in one of the cantos, here error is all in the not done, all in the diffidence that faltered. Or sometimes our self-view is just so wrong that it leads us in completely self-defeating directions. I can't help thinking of all the people who appear on X Factor, absolutely certain that they're superstars in the waiting, but are cruelly revealed to have no talent whatsoever, not for singing anyway. You think, how can they possibly believe that they can sing? But they're convinced of it. Nothing will persuade them otherwise. No evidence will make them change their minds. Their whole sense of themselves and of their value in the world hangs on them being the next pop sensation. So they spend years in pursuit of that goal. They might have been brilliant gardeners or astronomers, teachers, doctors, or even non-singing musicians, but no. If they can't be Madonna or Michael Jackson, they don't want to be anything. And when Simon Cowell tells them they're not going to be the next Madonna or Michael Jackson, they're furious, because they can't accept it. And then there are those real unfortunates who succeed on X Factor, and then forever afterwards are really stuck with a self-image of themselves as a great pop star, which I'm sure is very limiting, and a great hindrance to self-development. Anyway, there is a really quite startling episode in the story of the rich man's son, where the son not only doesn't recognise the father, he's terrified of him. His self-view of himself as lowly, as unworthy, is so extreme that the sight of this rich man plunges him into a fainting fit. He feels so comparatively helpless, he feels as though he's going to be destroyed. So this powerful being, he feels, isn't to be trusted. If the father tries to bring the son into his orbit, then he must want something terrible. He must want to destroy him, suspects the son. Yet we know that the son is looking at what he himself could easily become. He's looking at his own father. He's looking really at his own birthright. But he cowers, just as we do, or as I do anyway, in the face of what I think of as something superior to me, my betters. And sometimes that fear and suspicion cuts me off from a very good influence, cuts me off from a healthy aspiration for what I myself might become. This is, of course, what the son doesn't realise, that the rich, happy man he sees is himself in potential. Psychologically, his own higher self. So to him, this being is alien, to be feared, mistrusted, to run away from. So you can be afraid of your own higher self, in effect. You can be afraid of the more expansive, more creative, freer being that you could be. And you can be afraid of it because it threatens the self that you know now, the self-created world that you, that we understand. But there's nothing to fear. And that's what the sutra is telling us. In fact, there's everything to be joyful about if we've been lucky enough to come across the Buddha's teachings. Because, of course, what the sutra is telling us is that enlightenment is our birthright. Each human being, in fact, every living thing, has the potential to first learn from and then become a Buddha. There's no loss in becoming what you've always been in potential anyway. Only surprising gain. But for a large part of our lives, many of us don't move towards that goal. We don't try to grasp it. We don't try to grasp what, in a sense, is already ours. Immersed as we are, perhaps, in limiting self-views, we go off to seek fortunes. We hire ourselves out for labour. All sorts of adventures befall us. Then eventually, by some mysterious process, we come into the vicinity of the spiritual path, our true inheritance. Maybe we just come along to a Buddhist centre to learn about meditation, to help us sleep, maybe, or just to calm down. Then we start hearing about other Buddhist teachings. People are kind to us, hopefully. And gradually change. We open out. Sometimes there's even a sort of remembering. Oh yeah, this is how life's supposed to be. And we sort of think, oh yes, communication can be a pleasure. It can be clear and honest and enjoyable. People, all of us, can be open and friendly. Life can feel significant, full of meaning and value and purpose. It can even be beautiful. It's as if sometimes I feel we knew when we were younger what we expected of life, that we expected life to be that good, but it didn't happen. We wandered off, became adult and sophisticated, got caught up in the cut and thrust of life and lost sight of our higher values and our ideals. I know that something of that kind happened to me, because I am that son, by the way. I remember having high and perhaps naive ideals of what life could be like as a teenager. Then I drifted off. As I drifted on, I let a sort of cynicism take over me, I think. A sort of fear of life. A kind of habitual state of disappointment and of feeling trapped. I remember feeling that when I was about 30, that my life was over. That there was no chance I could reach anything higher or more exciting than the career I was in at the time, publishing. And I felt I was stuck in the one job I had for life and would never know anything else until retirement. I seriously thought that at the age of 30. And I reached a stage where I was so psychologically down and out that even I realised I had to do something. So I came here about 20 years ago, 21 years ago, just initially to learn to meditate. And I used to sort of cower at the back there among the books. I didn't really trust the teachers, and I didn't think anyone liked me anyway. But there was just about something about the place that kept drawing me back. I began to realise I'd found a place where people really did believe that life could be better, that in fact we all had infinite potential, and that life, far from being a slow retreat into an ever tighter, more embattled self, could be an endless expansion into a greater one.